Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for December 1st, 2010. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast. In it, I have a fun monologue examining the underlying notions behind the ever-popular zombie apocalypse. Also, I've got a new hacker word of the week. First, though, a few things. I was remiss in my last feature show before the holiday. I had fully intended to include a heartfelt thank you to my dear friend Chris Miller for all the work that he does for me in reviewing the drafts lately going into the feature casts that I include. I was not in a very happy state of mind. I'd been thinking too much, I think, about the TSA situation and all of my friends traveling, and so it unfortunately completely slipped my mind, so I'm making it up to him now. The last couple of drafts especially, the revisiting Geek Fatigue and the upcoming feature in a few weeks out that he's helping me with, really have benefited from his insight and his hard work. So thank you so much, Chris. You may have heard of his name before because he's been on this very podcast twice, once to talk about his experiences at PyCon this past year and 2 years ago when he was very fortunate to go to Google's developer event I.O. And he also sometimes posts poetry and essays of his own at ctmiller.net. I also, of course, have to thank Rob and Curtis, who made donations over the past 2 weeks. I think they both did them within a couple of days of each other. A nice gift to me over the holidays. Thank you so much, guys. Lastly, a super, super quick rundown on the support situation for the podcast for the past month, as it is the end of November and the beginning of December here. I earned $2.65 from AdBard, which is actually up a little bit. We'll see, as I said, through the end of the year, maybe into January, where the advertising situation is. I did pretty well on the donations, converting actually in this past month one-time donor into an ongoing donor. I'm up to 16 or 17 donors. Very happy with that. Down to 9 or 10 badges, so into the final run here, and happily looking at maybe running up some more or some other premium, although there's plenty of time at the rate that those have been going out 2 or 3 months before I have to make a decision. Flatter did quite well. I earned 11.39 euro for the month, which is about average for me at this point, which after the conversion rate to US is actually a nice bump up to the monthly financials. I'm looking at going into, I would project at the end of the year, close to $300 earned for the podcast after taking out, that's net, after taking out the expenses, which now are very, very few associated with it. And I'm really getting excited at this point with that money at the prospect of either reinvesting that into premiums for donors, which would still leave me money left over at that point, since everything I'm looking at runs about the same $200 that I invested in the badges originally, or putting that directly towards a round-trip flight somewhere to make it out to a technical conference in the coming year and to be able to say in the audio segments that I record there that I'm there thanks to the generosity of my listeners and supporters. I have two pieces of listener feedback to share with you. The first comes from Jed Reynolds, who wrote in response to the feature I did a few weeks back on API design. He writes, "I'm enjoying your episode on API design. I've more than once been in the position of designing an API and getting it not great. It's very difficult to solve a set of requirements and also design an API for your team members at the same time if your working habits lack code review and regular discussion. Deadline-heavy environments tend to create painful code and thus regret. I like designing in many languages and config files to help me reduce the amount of code I need to change to enable or disable diagnostic output and production configuration. However, I've had team members that thought this was frippery and insisted that using constants and variables in the code were faster and simpler to maintain because the responsibility for various features was not shared among the whole team. Thanks for that input, Jed. I think you've really hit the rub on why we're not always able to hit the mark on good API design. Those are all excellent points. Designing API suffers when there isn't a good amount of feedback, as you call out. I tend to concur with you on separating out configuration concerns. I put it in the same bucket as separating out logging, too. I suspect your constants and global static variable using peers are sometimes guilty of standard output simple print logging rather than using something a bit more durable and configurable. The other piece of feedback I got also through email was from Ethan, who wrote in response to the Revisiting Geek Fatigue episode. I agree with your thoughts on allowing oneself to drop a given pursuit when it just doesn't fit your schedule. As you say, you never know when you'll pick it up again, and we do well to let such pursuits slip into or out of our schedules when it helps us achieve larger goals. One reason that becomes difficult, I believe, is because of how we define ourselves. For example, if I define myself as a hacker, and also believe that hackers must have continuous personal coding projects, it's very difficult to let my personal coding projects lag. I'm faced with a few options. Modify my definition of a hacker, defiantly continue to define myself as a hacker, and explain away my behavior as a temporary anomaly, or redefine myself. Maybe ceasing to define oneself at all should be an option as well. All of this occurred to me because it seems like any course of action, where your habits are modified, results in some cognitive friction to overcome. I guess it's just a matter of picking your battles, weighing the various sources of friction, deciding which ones can be smoothed out with a little thought, and which you just have to plow through. Those are excellent thoughts, Ethan. Thank you for sharing them. Definitely, action helps define us, but in the case of being a hacker in particular, I think it's the attitude. One encompassing curiosity, coupled with the courage to act on that desire for more information, that's key beyond the actions. For me, anyway, coding is just one avenue of hacking, not exclusive, not the only one. This actually informs the dictum I close every show with, hack your world. Much more than computers can be hacked. So I think that might help a little bit with those decisions. And I would say the final option you put in there is definitely one worth considering, is maybe you don't need to hang your hat on some notional definition. That's also why in the intro I say I am a self-proclaimed hacker, because it's just a label I like to fix to myself. If somebody else comes along to your point and points out that I'm maybe not coding as much as I should be, I'm not evincing that well, then I can say not that I'm a hacker by action, but that I like to associate with that label. I appreciate all of the feedback I get. I want to thank again Jed and Ethan both. If you've got something that you'd like to share, you can send that to feedback@thecommandline.net. The hacker word of the week comes from The Jargon File, maintained by Eric Raymond at catb.org. Fish. Noun. Adelaide University, Australia. 1. Another metasyntactic variable. See foo. Derived originally from the Monty Python skit in the middle of The Meaning of Life entitled Find the Fish. 2. A pun for microfiche. A microfiche file cabinet may be referred to as a fish tank. When I don't have enough bile for a rant and can't muster the necessary peace and serenity for an inner chapter, all that's left is for me to express my evil genius side and do a monologue. When is a zombie not a zombie? My wife and I are fans of zombie films and fiction. I don't know that we've ever really discussed the reasons why. Our fascination predates the current craze over every book and movie that manages to cram in a handful of reanimated corpses. I was watching AMC's new series, The Walking Dead, with her when she compared the setting and story to a natural disaster. Once she put that idea into my head, I started comparing the series to, in particular, Alas, Babylon. I haven't read that book since high school, but it definitely stuck with me. It is probably one of the most realistic considerations of surviving a nuclear holocaust. The story of the survivors of a fictitious zombie apocalypse is surprisingly similar. This made me wonder at the deeper currents that animate the myth of the most primitive of undead creatures. Zombies as monsters are fairly simple. There's the obvious disgust evoked by their putrefaction. Our innate fear of mortality is also easily triggered by their obvious physical nature, that is, that they are literally the walking dead. A single zombie, though, is not especially strong, and the emotional shock of its appearance, at least in watching them on screen, wears off after a relatively short amount of time compared to other kinds of more terrifying monsters. One alone is easily evaded, according to most lore. Destroying a solitary shambling corpse is also relatively easy. Usually it only takes severing the head or destroying the brain. Given that decay also acts on the singular zombie, time is the ally of the living as the body continues to deteriorate, weakening it. A crowd of zombies is an altogether different matter, and is where the true danger and interest, for me, lies. The difference is like that between a quiet creek in the woods and the raging cataract it becomes after a particularly heavy deluge. In this case, the more rain that falls, the more the storm clouds grow in an ever-worsening cycle that feeds itself. Most zombie stories contain the idea of contagion and its spread. In some, that is as rapacious as a bite inflicted on the living, which will turn them undead. In other stories, the effect is much more pervasive, part of the environment, not based on an active attack. Whatever the animating agent is simply affects anything that dies, however it does so. Even in the more passive case, as the zombies overcome their victims, the fallen then swell their ranks, amplifying the threat and the terror. Early myths of zombification. I'm pretty sure that the earliest incarnation of zombies were supernatural. There is, of course, the voodoo tradition of raising the dead. In some instances, this is done as a form of dominion over an enemy. What greater humiliation than to be made into a mindless servant of an embittered foe carrying out their will? There is a parallel tradition, though, I think it's somewhat rarer, where the raised are conjured as spirits of vengeance, acting on some injustice done on them in life. The supernatural zombie had a clear quality of agency then. Either a powerful individual used their will, skills, or petition to an even stronger outside force in order to animate the dead. The motive of the formerly living is either completely subverted by an even stronger animosity, or directly harnessed to the justice it is tasked to serve in undeath. Perhaps because the supposed forces that gave such creatures most motion were almost universally assumed of an unearthly origin, these earliest creatures often were superhumanly strong by contrast to the modern zombie that I spoke about in the beginning. Out of the broader necromantic tradition, voodoo had somewhat of a seed of truth versus a lot of the other mythology that's clear exaggeration or fabrication. It's dressed up in a form of dramatics, perhaps, but there's an underlying phenomenon beneath it. The theatrics may have even helped focus real effects towards the desired will of the practitioner, like the vocal inflection and visual focus used by a hypnotist. Modern science and understanding chipped away at the mystery surrounding one form of the original, more solitary zombie. The Serpent and the Rainbow, for the dramatic elements in the film adaptation, was based at its heart on a true story about investigating the real phenomenon of zombieism. There is a certain parallel in black and white and early color cinema in the 40s and 50s in the U.S. Hypnotism or mesmerism held fascination for very similar reasons and often was harnessed to evoke terror and chills. The wife and I watched a black and white film, which we thought might have been the earliest zombie film of the modern genre in American cinema, but it was, as it turns out, a madcap whodunit where there was a liberal dash of mesmerism used to turn the victim also into the mechanism of murder in this instance. And unfortunately, I would link to this film in the show notes, but I can't find it. We can't remember the name of it. But it does, I think, illustrate that overlap, that kind of core nut of both traditions of one agent enforcing will against another. Later incarnations of the zombie are also more about their animating force. As the soul zombie scaled into the modern horde with which we are familiar, the agency behind them also outgrew the petty motives of any one person. The supernatural zombie continues in modern fiction. Laurel K. Hamilton's original heroine was a necromancer. Zombies pop up in the Laundry series by Charlie Strauss, one of my favorites that I've reviewed here repeatedly on the podcast. In both instances, the living dead are animated by outside forces. They might be truly alien as the mythos-inspired deep space and time entities in Strauss's work, but there is a sense of directed will behind them. What really fascinates me is the emergence of what I'll call the postmodern undead. Deconstructing the undead horde. The most enduring interpretation of the zombie disconnects it from any human agency. The zombie loses any individual identity, becoming one small part of a larger vessel for its animating force. Focus is shifted away from the zombie as a monster to the circumstances that give rise to the much more dangerous masses of the undead. In the most general case, the zombie plague represents our always-present, free-floating anxiety. The zombie is a blank into which we can pour our neuroses. These could be as topical as concern over the effect of mass consumerism on society, or as eternal as the unreasoning fear of contagion. This has allowed some filmmakers and writers to decouple nebulous fears from zombies as a specific embodiment, using variations and reinventions that aren't exactly reanimated corpses, but serve the exact same purpose as a template. From this arises arguments about which films qualify as zombies or not, like 28 Days Later or The Crazies, but misses the point that it isn't the manifestation per se, but what's behind it. The stock zombie plague abides in pop culture because of its very ability to take on whatever anxiety may be lurking in an audience's subconscious. It has been reinvented across at least two generations. The postmodern zombie is so malleable, we even have zombies and other remixes. Zombies have been thrown into all sorts of non-horror settings, or the horror has been cut and intermingled with comedy and other kinds of stories. Laughter and other emotions are juxtaposed with the underlying fear or revulsion to heighten the latter by allowing us periodic release through the former. The irradiated zombie. Night of the Living Dead has a reference to radiation as a cause for the rising of the dead from their graves. Playing on a television, a news anchor mentions a falling space probe believed to carry some radioactive contaminant. It's a reference easily missed, not mentioned again, really, in the rest of the film. This is clearly inspired by the Cold War and associated fears of nuclear destruction and fallout. The nightmare scenario of the day included the same destruction of infrastructure that goes along often with the zombie attack. Think about the post-nuke movies prevalent in the 80s, especially Mad Max. You can easily imagine the blight being visited by vast mobs of undead. Riders in the wasteland scavenge society itself, much like zombies devour anything remaining alive. Transmission of zombieism equates to the effects of radiation sickness. It's insidious, seemingly everywhere, but impossible to easily spot. In both cases, there is little to do for the affected or infected. Radiation can spread almost virally. Irradiated objects can themselves irradiate. I'm definitely thinking of the role of this phenomenon in the book A Last Babylon. Once a nuclear winter sets in, we have to wait for it to ride out its course. In both scenarios, there is little we can do except look to our own safety. Sometimes, governments remain intact enough to arrive late in the day to help out. Usually, though, we are left to fend for ourselves as best we can. Maybe as survivors of nuclear fire, there's an unconscious association with the dead. The post-war scenarios, then, may be even closer to zombie films than I had initially suggested. We have met the zombies, and we are them. You have those immediately obliterated, those dying slowly, and the survivors. Maybe the subconscious survivor's guilt blurs the line between the two groups of nuclear survivors. Or the line is as mutable as in a zombie outbreak. There are those infected with either zombieism or radiation poisoning, and those who will be infected. The the zombie pandemic. The fear of the nuclear threat seems to have faded with passing generations. Anxiety has shifted from that to new fears arising from increasing globalism and what unthinking application of science may have wrought in the form of antibiotic-resistant superbugs and new, ever more virulent strains of viruses. The ecologically minded may see epidemics as nature run amok. It defies medicine and technology's ability to cope, an impersonal force acting simply in reaction to us stressing our environment too far. In this scenario, there is no specific agency behind either the zombie or the plague, unlike the superpowers in the irradiated zombie scenario. We get closer to the idea of a natural disaster, yet there is still the embodiment of our fears. If we cannot face the all-too-real threat of a massive disease outbreak, the facade of zombies gives us a little distance, but still lets us poke at the idea like a sore tooth. The mechanism of zombies spreading, turning survivors into attackers, is uncomfortably close to how infection might flash through a population. Some popular science writers, like Jennifer Willett, draw uncomfortable comparisons between the two models. Willett does so to advance education in math, using a fun idea to explore it, but it relies on our almost instinctive understanding of the problem of a viral spread. In George Mann's first Newberry and Hobbes book, The Affinity Bridge, the revenants definitely are a form of zombie, and they originate from a far-flung corner of the then early British Empire, the very seeds of the globalization we're dealing with today. Even though the book has a historical setting, it clearly resonates with the modern shrinkage of the world. We develop our immunity to disease through exposure, but what unknown pathogens could spread through modern means of travel faster than we can individually and as groups cope? It makes sense in the current round of zombie stories to simply assume the phenomenon is viral in origin. In many cases, it's a simple conceit to get into the usual zombie tropes we're familiar with, but I hope I've argued to thinking about the close association of causes a little bit further. The manifestation may be familiar, but its motivation has been reinvented. A conspiracy of shamblers. I do want to allow for another trend with the last crop of zombie narratives. The close association of contagion with the undead isn't always so simple as I make out. Maybe this relates to shadow agents back during the days of the Cold War, that a nuclear strike isn't an act of God as much as the aftermath may seem that way. With the disease model, it could be inspired by a distrust of corporations. The Umbrella Corporation in the Resident Evil franchise is a good boogeyman in this mode. It is relatively faceless, pursuing profit at all expenses, even if in so doing it unleashes a zombie nightmare. The truly cynical might see this as less of an accident, as it is the same corporation that swings into action to contain the situation after the fact. Is it so far a stretch, at least to the conspiracy-minded, to see a manufactured zombie outbreak as a logical extrapolation of that corrupting urge to profit? Responsibility and underlying concern need not fall totally on the private sector, however. Any large enough organization could easily be demonized for unleashing the undead. The government's repeated poor handling of actual natural disasters might inform stories where the government has a concerning or outright nefarious role. In both of Danny Boyle's films, 28 Days Later and 28 Weeks Later, the military becomes another force to fear, whether we fear their role in causing the situation or in their final solution. Allow me to be clear, I don't subscribe to conspiracy theories myself, but I understand the power that they possess. We often feel out of control in our lives and want someone to blame. Any organization big enough, corporate or governmental, can become a target. Playing this out in a zombie story pits one vague fear then against another. This even sometimes affords us the pleasure of seeing a comeuppance. The would-be architects of zombie plagues are so often consumed by it. It is almost a pride before the fall trope, but with the undead and too-big-to-fail organizations. I wonder, with the downturn of the economy in recent years and the increased focus on the financial sector, if we'll see a few more examples of this take on the idea. Wouldn't you love to see some generic boardroom crashed and some horrified flunky relating that this is someone, a lab or a project, that some shady financiers inadvertently backed through one too many specious financial instruments? What future lies in store for the zombie? Given the past reinventions of the genre, I can't help but wonder what we might see next. One that occurs to me is a marriage of nanotechnology's nightmare, gray goo, with the zombie apocalypse. Runaway self-replicating nano has that same explosive, exponential growth aspect as the spread of undead through the ranks of survivors. Recurring imagining of nano is application in medicine. I would not be surprised at all if someone has already written a story in this vein. It's simply a matter of where our fears about the world at large settle next that will decide what the next generation ultimately will be. These are just some of my thoughts on the science, technology, and history of this science fictional trope of zombies that has us so in its thrall. Undoubtedly, you have your own favorite films, books, and stories in this vein that you might like to share. As always, you can send those to me at feedback@thecommandline.net, where I'd be happy to share them with everybody else. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening, especially for putting up with my holiday hiatus. I'm glad to be back. If you enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. Or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all the ways you can financially help out with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you can post those as a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If you need to get in touch with me securely, details of my public key pair can be found at thecommandline.net/GNUPG-fingerprints. The next show, which should go out in the feed Sunday night, will be a news program as usual, so until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits and you share your changes under the same license.